The following talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi during a Fusatsu ceremony at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
So good evening. Good evening to those of you who are joining us from the continuous thread and those who are just showing up tonight. We're in the middle of Sesshin, and this is Fusatsu, Renewal of Vows. And this really harkens back to the time of the Buddha when the monastics would, and still, I believe, would gather periodically and renew their vows, their monastic vows. And in that way, be given an opportunity to acknowledge any of those vows that they had transgressed or not lived within, so that the Sangha, both as individuals and collectively, could continue to have integrity within their Dharma practice. In the fascicle that we're studying, The Moon by Master Dogen, Master Dogen speaks about the Buddha body and the boundless body. He says, at the moment of awakening, others with a Buddha body, that Buddha body comes forth and expounds the Dharma. At the moment of awakening others with a boundless body, the boundless body manifests and expounds the Dharma. Buddhism speaks about these different bodies of the Buddha. I've spoken a little bit about that earlier. In the realization of Buddhahood that Bodhidharma spoke of, a direct point into the human mind without relying on words and letters or sutras, the realization of Buddhahood, that's the realization of this boundless body, our self-nature, and to realize that that's the nature of others, too, and of all things. Boundless, limitless, Dogen says it's like the open sky. That all things are naturally so in their original state, with no beginning or end. In the realization of this boundless body, we realize that the season of great peace is here. At the moment of awakening others with a Buddha body, the Buddha body comes forth. The Buddha body is the form in which the boundless body takes shape. That as important as the Buddha is to us and is to all of Buddha Dharma and Buddhism, that it's teachers in the present who guide us, that we have a living, dynamic, ongoing training relationship with. Without my teacher, Dada Roshi, I wouldn't be here. My life would be going who knows where, how, what. And so that Buddha body is essential, and it is the Buddha body that brings forth the teachings of the boundless body, manifests Buddha Dharma. In a sense, when we're practicing well, sincerely, I don't mean well in terms of matching your report card, but when we're actually practicing the Dharma well, sincerely, in accord with the Dharma, both the Buddha body and the boundless body are beginning to appear. The affirmation of that is the various experiences that we have that are affirming that practice is yes. And in that, something is being offered to the world. This boundless body is free of right and wrong, good and evil, but to be fully actualized, it must be in harmony with the Buddha body. And Dogen says we have to harmonize inner and outer. So much of practice and training is not just about that direct pointing, realizing Buddha nature, but about manifesting that, which in a way is much more challenging. In the realization of self-nature, habits, underlying dispositions, history, karma, can't be found. But at the moment we come forth in this historical body, in this karmic body, all of those habits, the ones that still remain strong, still remain. And so the precepts, the essential aspect of this path, the Buddha said, the sila, the precepts, living a moral life, not creating harm, being a benefit to self and other, along with the calming of the turbulent waters within us, and that realization, that direct pointing into the self nature, that those three elements, in a sense, are what the Buddhist path is. And so the precepts are one manifestation of that. The three treasures, for us, the three treasures, the pure precepts and the 10 gray precepts, based in selflessness, the boundless body, in which there is no discord, there is no conflict, there's no apart. But how to bring that forth? There is no clinging, there's no attachment, there's no strife or worry, but how to bring that forth into both the body in which there are still aspects of that and into our relationships in which there's plenty still going on, and how to harmonize that. And so we begin practicing the precepts, these teachings, at the very beginning, at the start of the path. And they're not unfamiliar to anyone. I mean, before you even counter them as the Buddhist teachings on morality, some of them are present in their own forms within other religious traditions. And the ones that may not be explicitly so kind of make sense. It's not that they're things we've never thought about or encountered or hopefully tried to live by. They're universal recognitions of how to live well together. And they're centered in enlightenment. They're centered in the way things are. They're not just the Buddha's or somebody's idea of, you know, well, let's make up some rules. We think of it as a kind of coming forth from this deep place of enlightenment, of the enlightened mind. And then how does that naturally manifest in harmony with others and self? How to not create harm. Sounds so easy. Just don't do it. Okay? Let's just all agree tonight, together. From now on, we won't create harm. Not likely to happen. Right? Even as heartfelt as we might be. Let's be a benefit to others. Okay, let's make another agreement right now. Sounds easy enough. And so there has to be more. Yes, to establish that as a commitment, as a vow. Of course, that's essential. But we have to learn how, or perhaps relearn how to live a true, peaceful life. And so because these precepts function within time and space, they can be written on a page. Affirm life, don't kill, be generous, don't steal, so on. They appear as do's and don'ts. Do this, don't do this. Right? Again, familiar guidelines. We've encountered that before, starting when we were little. But because they're based in boundlessness and selflessness, they are not rules. They are not fixed. They are unambiguous. They're clear. But they are not rules. Why? In one of the connected discourses where some of the women disciples of the Buddha were practicing and were visited by Mara, one of them, Sisupakala Sutta, one of the disciples of the Buddha, after having gotten up in the morning and done her morning ablutions and gone into town to beg for her meal for the day, and then returning, having her meal, she sat down at the base of a tree for the day's abiding, for her day's meditation. And then Mara came to visit her, approached the bhikkhuni, Sisupakala, and said to her, "Whose creed do you adhere to, bhikkhuni? Whose creed do you follow?" And she says, I don't adhere to anyone's creed, friend. And Mara said, but you've shaved your head. You appear to be a renunciant, a mendicant, a nun, yet you don't approve of any creed? Are you just wandering around, bewildered? And Susupakala said, the followers of creeds place their confidence in views. I don't approve of those teachings. They are not skilled in the Dharma. But there is a scion of the Sakyan clan, the enlightened one, without an equal, conqueror of all, Mara's subduer, who everywhere is undefeated, everywhere freed and unattached, the one with vision who sees all, who attained the end of all karma and released in the extinction of acquisitions. That blessed one is my teacher. His is the teaching I approve. And then Mara, the evil one, realizing that the bhikkhuna Susupakala knows me, he said, was sad and disappointed and left. So a creed is a set of beliefs which guide our actions. If she doesn't follow a creed, what does she follow? Is she following something? She didn't actually say that. What she did say was, the Buddha is my teacher. It's his teaching that I approve. That's what she said. We speak of following the precepts. We take these vows. We speak about following them all the time. We talk about following the Dushinji Code. These various guidelines, the precautions of Sesshin. And they do guide our actions. They help us hold ourselves within this body and mind with our various karmic impulses and inclinations, with our thoughts and desires. And they guide us, or we guide ourselves, rather, by, we might say, following those rules. But why do I say that they are not rules to be followed? Well, in every moment, living the life of as a bodhisattva, as long as there is bodhicitta, as long as there is intention, there is an awareness, and then there's an action, and then there's a response. But in that, where is the creed? Where is the rule? What is being followed? There's just an intention, an awareness, an action, a response. It's like when we use a map. If we hold the map in front of our face, we'll trip over everything, right? And we won't be able to follow it. The map doesn't tell us where to go, right? We actually have to study the map and then ingest it, right? Take that in and apply it in time and space. If we ignore the precepts, right, then we're not practicing Buddha Dharma. If we just do what the precepts tell us to do, then we're not really practicing them either. We might be following a rule, but we're not practicing the precepts. That kind of following of rules binds us, and the Buddha was very clear about how we can bind ourselves, that in that way, the precepts become rules, become fetters. They don't liberate us. That Roshi used to always say when he was giving the precepts, these precepts are not intended to bind us, they're intended to help set us free. In Wu Men's Zen warnings at the end of the Wu Men Con, one of his warnings is to observe the regulations and keep to the rules is tying oneself without a rope. On the other hand, to act freely and unrestrainedly, just as you wish, is to do what a heretic or demon would do. Right? Just do whatever I want. Or to keep to the rules, to just observe the regulations and rules. In other words, to reduce something that is alive and dynamic and demands, requires our clear attention, because every moment is changing, every situation, every person is in a constant state of becoming. And so if we bind ourselves, if we blind ourselves by holding the map in front of us, if we want to follow anything, follow the reality that appears before our eyes. Even if we think of the literal perspective of the precepts that we teach in our lineage. The first understanding of the precepts is just observe them as they are expressed. To affirm life and not kill means just that. To honor the truth and not speak falsely means just that. Never speak falsely. Even when we, and that's just one perspective, but even when we practice it that way, we realize quickly that for those to actually be a compassionate action, we cannot just be following that as a rule. Because there are many times where doing that will cause harm. In other words, there's the need to respond in a live way to a moment in order to abide by the spirit of that precept, which is not creating harm and being a benefit. And so that means we have to discern, we have to be thoughtful, we have to reflect, we have to be alive. As a rule, the precept is an idea, it's something printed on a page. Precepts are living things. Compassion is a living, awake, dynamic something. It's not like anything. What would we call it? And it's a union of that boundless and Buddha body. It's a union of the self appearing in this form and selflessness. It's a union of an ancient wisdom that is universal in our present circumstances and situations. It's a union between trusting ourself deeply and being responsible for our delusion. And so we learn from the precepts. We learn by practicing them as living things, in living situations, with living people, that is moving, and that is responsive to everything we do. And we too are part of that. And so we have to reflect, we have to see into our intentions, we have to see how clear those are, either in that moment or later, that we observe the consequences of our actions. Because it's not over, that action isn't over. It's still manifesting. And when we don't live in accord with our intentions, when we create harm, then we practice atonement. When others don't practice that, and that washes up on our shore, we have the opportunity to practice forgiveness. Compassion, the four immeasurables, sending and receiving. Those are real practices, right? We're not just pretending to do something every morning at the end of Zazen. This sounds nice, let's do it. It's a real offering. And sometimes we just offer it from our seat and fill our minds with that heartfelt wish and bring someone or someone's into view and offer it to them. And sometimes it's what's happening right in front of us. It's having a difficult conversation. It's wanting to set out on the path of forgiveness when we're not yet ready to forgive. It's atoning again for an action that we have that is part of our habit pattern. That we deeply want to free ourselves up, but there it is again. And so that's why we must practice deeply and honestly and with courage and faith. You know, Dada Roshi gave a talk once where he talked a lot about how mistakes is called learning. That we cannot learn, we cannot practice without fumbling. That a child cannot walk without stumbling. We actually call it toddling, right? They're a toddler. Well, kind of, maybe we are toddling our way, right, into the life of a bodhisattva. And so that means we have to be large enough to hold our own stumbling at the same time that we are serious about our intentions and our vows, right? Like if somebody hurts you and they apologize and they just keep doing it over again with no clear effort to change anything, you stop trusting them, right? It doesn't mean anything. So we do need to actually demonstrate and have demonstrated our sincerity and at the same time recognize that there are deep inclinations and dispositions that exist within each and every one of us that will show up again. Quite possibly, let's say. Don't know. You don't know. And when we atone, as we did at the beginning of Fusatsu, this teaches us how to face ourselves, face our actions, face the consequences, face whatever it was on account of my beginningless greed, anger, and delusion, what it was that was bringing that forth, that action, and to take responsibility without shame. Regret will be there, right, if our heart is open. But without shame, shame is not necessary. Punishment is not necessary. That only is more suffering, creating more suffering. Rather, to make contact with our own innate, present, inherent goodness and our inclination towards kindness, which can get obstructed. Thanissara in the book Stand, Time to Stand Up, the readings that we presented for Ango said, within the womb of awareness, body, sensation, mind, and phenomena can be known directly. She's talking about the four foundations of mindfulness. That is to come into deep and direct contact with body, sensation, mind, and phenomena. And she says, this is a deeply compassionate activity. We might not see that. This is a deeply compassionate activity in and of itself. She says, from Prajnaparamita's formless, loving, undivided, intuitively intelligent womb of awareness, wisdom is born. Without this, there is no Buddha. And so that is, practice is in and of itself a deeply compassionate activity. That alone is not enough to fully bring that compassion out and to harmonize it, to integrate it, to shift the karma of those deep underlying inclinations. That we need to actively practice, deliberately practice, daily practice. Those are our vows. Those are our metta practices. That's how we face ourselves when we sit. It's how we face each other, particularly in times of difficulty. Because we know that in times of difficulty, it's easy to revert back to a difficult way of being. Dogen says, a single mind realizes the mind of all things. It is all-inclusive. It is all-inclusive of the world, all-inclusive of the entire body. And so when Sasupakala says, I don't approve of anyone's creed, friend, Mara is not her enemy. She doesn't approve of anyone's creed, and she has completely dedicated her life to the way. She's living it. She is it. She does not adhere to any creed. Right? That would be to create something apart. She is not attached to any view, but she has devoted her life to living the true nature of things. Her teacher is the one who is everywhere, freed and unattached. We can practice that. I hope we are practicing that. In the commentary to the Uttara Tantra Sutra on Buddha nature, it says, what is called Buddha is that which is best possible benefit for yourself and the best possible benefit for others. Very simple. What is Buddha is that which is of the best possible benefit, which means we have to go way beyond any idea or imagining of what that might be. Because whatever we might imagine that to be is going to be much, much too limited. Not the best possible benefit. And that along the path that they be, that we vow that they both be finally perfected, that is, fully realized, fully actualized. And this is equivalent to the true Dharma body. This is that boundless body coming forth. And so when we practice and realize the Dharma, then we see that boundless body coming forth. Then it's much easier to see when we are not living in accord. Right, the more we let go of every desire to turn towards suffering, to turn towards disharmony, to create the kleshas, greed, anger, delusion, the less we want that, then the more easily and naturally we see when we have turned towards that, because that's not what we want. So much of the struggle in the years of practice until that shifts is wanting and not wanting. I want it, I don't want it. I want it, I don't want it. I want it, I don't want it. I let it go, I pick it back up. I let it go, I pick it back up. And so when we practice this way, we are bringing forth selflessness even before we've realized it. We are manifesting the Buddha body even before we understand it. And all the while to see that they're not apart. That that struggle is not between two sides, two parts of yourself, good and evil, saint and demon. That's a story. That's a story that describes our ordinary way of perceiving what we do experience. But it's not the true story. Dogen says, no matter whether the yin spirit or the yang spirit illuminates, no matter whether the moon is a fire jewel or a water jewel, a Buddha body is always immediately actualized. We can't help it. You can't help it. Here it is. Having faith in that, then we really recognize it is not something we are going to create. It's not something we are distant from, even in our most distant moments. It does not require and will not respond well to a fight. And so we return to these vows, these precepts, we reflect, we invoke the names of the Buddha, the four vows, the three treasures, to remember again and align ourselves with what is important. That is not a rule, is not a creed, is not even Buddhism, not at its heart. But you could say it's you.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.